Over NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent and affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Be sure to listen for a special announcement at the close of this program. Now we present Alton A. Linford of the School of Social Service Administration of the University of Chicago. Mr. Linford.
Since 1945, President Truman has several times urged Congress to enact a broad national health program. In speaking of an economic bill of rights, President Truman listed the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, and the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of sickness. In a special message to Congress, the President called for a five-point program to bring about these objectives. One, federal aid for the construction of needed hospitals and other facilities. Two, expansion of federal aid for state and local public health, maternal and child health services. Three, federal aid for medical education and research. Four, expansion of our present social insurance system to provide protection against the loss of wages from sickness and disability. And five, expansion of our existing compulsory social insurance system to provide for the prepayment of medical costs. Today's roundtable is concerned with only the last of these points. Whether we should have a government national compulsory health insurance system created by the Congress. Compulsory health insurance was an issue in last year's political campaign, with Truman advocating and Dewey opposing it. Congress will, in the present session, give serious consideration to the health insurance problem. Joining me in a discussion of should we adopt compulsory health insurance are Dr. Morris Fishbein, editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, and Nelson Cruikshank, Social Security Director of the American Federation of Labor. Cruikshank, why do you favor the adoption of compulsory health insurance?
Our people favor it, and we're for it all the way, for a very simple reason. And that's because working people in the main have found that in an industrial society, there are four main hazards that confront them. First is the hazard of death, especially to the breadwinner. Second, dependent old age. Third, loss of income through unemployment. And fourth, both loss of income through sickness and the cost of medical care. Now, through private insurance programs and through old age and survivors insurance set up under the Social Security Act, the first two have largely been taken care of. In a large measure, the unemployment insurance programs carried on by the states remove the risk of involuntary unemployment. Now, workers believe that through a disability program, the loss of wages through sickness can be met, and lastly, that the cost of medical care, the severe cost of medical care that confronts workers, can be met by the extension of these well-tried and proven principles of insurance to meet the cost of medical care, and that's why we support a health insurance program. We believe, and the Federation has stated just this week, that there should be a broad national health program based on a system of health insurance covering a major proportion of the population. They have stated that it should include provision for medical research, training of personnel, and construction of needed health programs. They then proceeded to state five particular specific guarantees to provide that under the insurance system, The privileges of both those who provide service and those who receive them under such a program will be protected.
Dr. Fishbein, why do you not favor compulsory health insurance?
The American Medical Association has consistently opposed compulsory sickness insurance under the government, first because it brings the government as a third party between the doctor and his patient every time the patient sees the doctor. Second, it regiments the doctors and regiments the patients. Third, it inevitably lowers the quality of medical service, and we have today in the United States the highest standard of medical service available anywhere in the world. Fourth, it introduces a powerful factor of compulsion on the vast majority of American people. Fifth, it is not insurance, it is taxation, since it involves a deduction from the worker's wages and a tax on the employer equivalent to the deduction on the worker's wages. And everybody now agrees that the system would be so costly that inevitably there would have to be additional funds from general tax funds to make up the total costs. And finally, of course, these guarantees about which Mr. Cruikshank speaks are utterly without any validity, simply because by regulation, government can change a guarantee overnight.
Well, gentlemen, it's clear that we have rather sharp difference of opinion on this question. Before we explore those issues, I wonder if we could have some agreement on what do we mean by compulsory health insurance. Cruikshank, what do you mean by compulsory health insurance?
Well, you're quite right. Of course, there are serious areas of disagreement in the issues that Dr. Fishbein mentioned. I would challenge every one of them. But to move on with our statement of the subject, what do we mean by compulsory health insurance? First, it is just what it says. It's insurance. And that's an old American principle. The matter of pooling resources to spread the risks which people are confronted with. We had it first in fire insurance, and it spread to another number of other risks. Under our proposed plan, a fund would be created, which would be made up of the contributions based on a percentage of payroll paid by those who were covered under the plan, and out of that fund, the costs of medical care would be paid. These costs, which are now serious and which are often catastrophic in nature and which often drive workers into the relief fund or to the relief rolls or send him to the loan shark, that would be done away with. Now, on that word compulsory, we won't dodge that issue. We'll grasp the nettle because compulsory is a word which many people, including ourselves, usually don't like. But by compulsory, we mean in this program that you must cover as many people as possible. No insurance system will work where the risks are selected and you have all the bad risks because it makes it too expensive. And any insurance system where those who just are confronted with the risk will rush into it would not work. Life insurance would not work if you just had old people going into it. The premiums would be prohibitive in cost. So we say it should be compulsory in order to include as great a number of people as possible and spread the risk as widely as possible among the good and bad risks. It is not compulsory with respect to the relationship between the doctor and the patient. It is not compulsory with regard to the type or kind of medical care that is selected. It is only compulsory in terms of the widest possible spread.
Dr. Fishbein, do you agree with this statement of the definition of compulsory health insurance?
The word compulsory is the exact opposite of the word voluntary. 80 million people in the United States bought life insurance and are covered with some $200 billion worth of life insurance, and nobody made anybody buy any of it. 52 million people carry today voluntary hospitalization insurance. Not one of them had to buy into that. I agree, of course, that insurance is important because it does spread the risk. However, the compulsory federal health insurance now proposed does not cover the very poor people who can't pay anything and who don't have jobs. It doesn't cover the 11 million old people over 65 years of age who need medical care more, perhaps, than all the rest of the population together. It is not an all-inclusive coverage of the vast majority of the American people with a high quality of medical care. That is what we want to achieve, and we believe that that can be achieved by voluntary methods in a shorter time and to better satisfaction than it can be achieved by a compulsory technique that will regiment both doctors and patients.
Cruikshank, you have defined health insurance as a device for pooling the risks or creating a national fund out of which medical care can be paid for those who are covered in the system. And you've said something about the hazard of illness and the costs and so on. How big is this problem of the nation's sickness bill? How urgent is this matter of insurance?
It's a tremendous problem, though one that is very difficult to measure in exact statistical terms, and I wouldn't attempt to do it. However, among the hundreds of thousands of people who today, I trust, are listening on this program, we know, and they know, that people are confronted with a serious cost of care which prevents them often from seeking the kind of high-quality medical care that they need at its early stages. It keeps them from getting the best medical care that today is available in the United States. There is a barrier, an economic barrier, and it's tremendous. We know, for example, that the loss from our industry, from sickness, is 31 times the amount that is lost through strikes each year. Now, we have a good bit to be said about strikes, but a bill here in terms of productivity, by the loss of people taken out of productive effort by illness, is 31 times that of the strike loss. We know that to the individual, he is confronted with a thing which he can't budget, a cost which he can't budget except through insurance.
Dr. Fishbein?
I would agree with Mr. Cruikshank on practically everything that he said there. I am convinced that medical costs are high, and I know that they're high simply because modern medicine offers so much more than the old-time family doctor used to offer 100 years ago. I agree that the economic hazard is considerable because of the loss of man days, but I'm not convinced that sickness insurance would help that considerably because in some countries more man days were lost following the establishment of a compulsory sickness insurance than previously. And finally, the largest single cause of disability and absenteeism in industry is rheumatic disease, and we've recently established a National Arthritis Foundation to go to work on research on rheumatic disease because we do not know the exact cause of rheumatic disease. We have no specific method of treatment, and the mere fact that you give the fellow money to be cared for doesn't mean that he's going to go back to work.
Well, of course, we believe that the removal of this economic barrier, while it would not solve all problems, would have a great deal to do with solving them by making medical care available. And I challenge Dr. Fishbein on his statement that countries that have such a system have more man days lost through illness than they did before. There are no comparable statistics in any country to substantiate that.
Well, the oldest system was the German system, and the figures are available as to man days lost before and after the establishment of the German system.
But they are
not
comparable
statistics. Every year
statistics.
Up to the time when Hitler threw the system out.
Gentlemen, I think we've agreed that there is, both of you agree, there is an economic obstacle here. Would you agree that even if it, assuming for the moment or not entering into a discussion of whether it will improve the quality of medical care, would it relieve the insecurity, the mental insecurity of people in fearing the onset of an illness that would be excessively burdensome on their financial resources?
That's a psychosomatic question, and I have no doubt that people fear many things from which they ought to be relieved, and I think people always fear unusual expenses which they had not budgeted. And from that point of view, I have no doubt that both voluntary and compulsory sickness insurance have a psychosomatic effect. But how to measure that, I wouldn't know, short of having all the people covered by one or the other and seeing what happened.
It's not only a fear that it would remove, but it would remove a retarding influence of people going to their doctor in the early stages. Working people particularly are often confronted with the problem of having some symptoms which give them a vague fear, and they come just at the time when they have to decide whether they will go and have that expensive medical checkup and that thorough physical examination, or whether they're going to send daughter Mary off to school.
There.
And they postpone that thing because they don't want to deprive the members of their family of other benefits. And then they postpone it, and later on it's a serious illness, sometimes resulting in death. It's that kind of thing that the provision through insurance of meeting the cost of medical care would do that we're interested in.
Mr. Cruikshank has emphasized one of the great dangers of the whole system, and that is of simply overwhelming the medical facilities that our country can provide in a reasonable time, even in 10 or 20 years, with a great mass of trivial illness, making it utterly impossible for the medical profession and the hospitals to give to difficult cases the kind of care that they need.
Well, Doctor, it looks as if I want to send the people to the doctor and you want to keep them away from the doctor.
I know. You said exactly something that has no bearing whatever.
Well, gentlemen, the AMA opposes compulsory health insurance, though, Dr. Fishbein, you agree that there is a problem here. Now, what do you propose? What does the AMA recommend as a program to meet this problem?
The doctors are obviously more familiar with disease than many others because they are living with it constantly. We propose, first of all, the widest possible extension of public health, since half the counties of the United States do not now have adequate public health services. We propose, through the state agencies, complete maternal and child welfare services so as to make sure that every mother and child would have proper care, prenatal and postnatal. We propose the widest possible extension of voluntary sickness insurance, and as I have already said, 52 million people have hospitalization insurance, and that can be raised within 2 to 3 years to 70 or 80 million people. And we can add to that gradually the risks that are not covered by hospitalization, including surgical and catastrophic illnesses. We propose the proper medical care for our veterans, and the veterans are in considerable doubt right now about this compulsory sickness insurance system because they would then have to pay a tax for something that they now get apparently out of general government funds. The philanthropies of the United States have grown tremendously within the last few years, including the Polio Foundation, the Red Cross, the Cancer Society, the Heart Association, the Arthritis Fund, and they take care of a vast amount of illness which would not be cared for under a compulsory sickness insurance system.
Well, now, Mr. Linford, this is interesting because we agree on all of these things that Dr. Fishbein has recommended. We want the local health units established. We want the construction of more hospitals. We want environmental factors taken care of and all. But we maintain that our experience over the last 20 years has shown very clearly that these alone will not do the job. We must remove the economic barrier between people and their doctor. We must, the experience under the Hospital Construction Act has shown that we can't even meet the need of constructing the proper number of hospitals, the proven need of new hospitals, because in the areas of greatest need, there is not the means of supporting the hospitals. People don't have the ways of paying for the care that they would get in these hospitals. So we add to that program a system of insurance that would enable people to pay for all of these fine facilities.
Gentlemen, you have both agreed here on an insurance system. Dr. Fishbein, you say that the government system will regiment the doctor and the patients. It'll lower the quality of medical care. It'll inject a third party. What is it about voluntary insurance that's so different than government that would bring about these results so different than what you suppose would come from voluntary health insurance?
The main issue is, of course, the fact that a vast mass of medical service, and some of it unnecessary, would be thrown on facilities and on a medical profession beyond what they can care for reasonably, although these things are constantly growing by evolutionary processes. In addition to that, I want to mention briefly the fact that Mr. Cruikshank's proposal to tie up research and medical education into the compulsory sickness insurance system is the greatest threat of all, because fundamental to all good medical care is an exceedingly high standard of medical education without governmental controls. The medical colleges of the United States have voted recently unanimously not to accept government aid in their advance toward higher standards and a wider spread of medical education.
Cruikshank, what about this question? Would the government have to set up a lot of controls over the doctors and over the patients in order to set up health insurance?
No, they would not. Regulations that would necessarily be developed with in connection with any such program, as provided in our proposals, are regulations which the people and the doctors themselves agree on. That's the democratic process carried right through and all the way to the local unit, the small town, the village, the county, through state programs, and the people themselves participate in it. As it is now, the people have practically no participation. The matter of medical care and service is a two-party proposition. And today, it's a one-party proposition with the doctors controlling it and the people having nothing to say about it.
That statement is absolutely without any validity, and anybody that's ever been to a doctor knows better than that, because you go into the doctor, you don't have to stay there. You can ask him, how much does it cost? If it costs too much, you can walk out. There's no compulsion. And that statement is absolutely without any validity whatever as to the nature of medical practice in the United States today.
Dr. Fishbein, I gather what Cruikshank's getting at are these medical society-sponsored prepayment plans in which the doctors have sole control and...
Not all of them. In some states, by state law, they have control. In other states, by state law, they do not have control.
And furthermore, that is growing.
I would like to ask Mr. Cruikshank if he knows anything else that the government pays for in which the government does not control it, in which they do not control completely by regulation and by the forms used under the service, so that the government is at all times in complete control of the process.
We don't propose that the government control this. We propose only that the people use the instrument of government for collecting and disbursing the fund. The bill which we have seen introduced again this year is one which sets up particular guarantees. Now, on those guarantees that we mentioned, there are five in number, and our time is passing. I will not list them in detail here. But I will say that I, for one, think that when the government of the United States establishes a guarantee and a protection to me, that I have faith in that and I have confidence in it. And I believe the other people in the United States have confidence in their government to maintain a guarantee of liberty and freedom under this or any other program.
You know that one Congress can pass a bill and the next Congress reject it.
Well, gentlemen, it seems to me we've also brought up the fact here that there are not enough doctors or hospitals or dentists or nurses. And it's been said by some that... It would be impossible or unwise to put a national health insurance system into effect until we get the doctors, get enough doctors. What do you think about that?
The total supply of doctors in the United States is today, as both Mr. Cruikshank and you, Professor Linford, will admit, greater than that in any other country in the world. We have one doctor to about 715 people, whereas the next nearest country only has one doctor to 1,100 people. I believe that we will have to supply more doctors simply because people are learning more and more to ask for medical care. And our armed forces have increased tremendously, and the government itself is demanding more doctors than apparently the supply can meet. That's for the Army, the Navy, the Veterans, the Air Force, the Public Health Service, and many other agencies. So that... we must have more doctors. Now, we have recently created five new medical schools, and there are five others in prospect. And I am quite sure that medical education will meet the demand for doctors. Since, however, medical education takes 8 to 10 years, you can grant that it will be 10 years before we can begin.
Well, I agree that we need more doctors. And I agree, too, that the insurance program won't meet all the problems of medical care. We've never claimed that it would. And that's why we say that it must be a part of a movement on a broad front against this problem of medical care. But here's the thing that confronts me. Dr. Fishbein has assured us that with the rapid extension of voluntary medical care, we can soon provide this for everybody. And yet he says under our program that it can't be done because there aren't enough doctors. Now, the question of whether there are enough doctors isn't related to whether it's a government-sponsored program or a purely private program. But he gives it away because of this, that in these 52 million that he's talking about that are covered under the voluntary program, it's a big number only because because very few of them provide complete medical care. That program wouldn't, I grant you, be the drain on the supply of doctors that our program would, simply because it doesn't meet as much of the problem.
Gentlemen, one of the questions that a lot of people are concerned about in respect to this problem is whether the nation can afford a compulsory health insurance system. How much will it cost? Crookshank?
Well, the question is, can it afford not to have it? Can we afford to wait and fool around with a lot of little programs that are not meeting the need for medical care? What it will cost in terms of money, I don't know. People today spend about $6 billion on it, on medical care, and they're not getting enough, and what they get isn't good enough. What it will cost, it'll cost something more than that in money. But I say we can't afford to be without it any longer. We must provide health to our people.
I don't naturally look at the money question with that very fancy view, for the simple reason that this is a tax and workers are already complaining that taxes are too high, that they can't buy food, they can't get housing, they can't get other essentials of life, and this proposes simply to increase taxes by an additional percentage, and it merely means that more and more money will go into government and less money into medical care.
Gentlemen, we have agreed that there is an economic obstacle between many people and the medical care that they need. You have agreed that insurance is one of the methods that should be used to try to bridge this gap or remove this obstacle. Dr. Fishbein believes that it can be done and should be done through voluntary health insurance measures. Crookshank believes that health insurance can be effectively applied only by the government through a compulsory health insurance system.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've been listening to the University of Chicago Roundtable discuss Should We Have Federal Health Insurance? With Nelson Crookshank, economist for the American Federation of Labor, Dr. Morris Fishbein, editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association, and Alton A. Linford of the School of Social Service Administration of the University of Chicago as participants. This week's roundtable pamphlet includes the full text of today's discussion, reading lists, special illustrations, and a complete description of the University of Chicago roundtable home study courses. You will want to receive this pamphlet and to study the supplementary material on the problem of good health care in the nation. Be sure to write for your copy and send 10 cents in coin with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. For $3, you may subscribe to the pamphlet for a full year and receive 52 weekly issues. Now I'll repeat the address. The University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. And next week, the roundtable will discuss what should we do about the federal budget. Now, a special announcement.
Why is it that the Marshall Plan will fail if trade among the countries of Europe is not increased? The London Economist editorial says, and other American newspaper editorials repeatedly tell us, there is a dollar shortage in Europe. The term dollar shortage has become a fashionable stereotype to explain the many new difficulties in world trade. But do you understand why the term dollar shortage is a misleading, question-begging concept? To understand the underlying conditions that determine the role of American dollars in transferring goods and services into and out of the United States, it is necessary to know two basic economic concepts, namely, the principle of comparative advantage and the function of exchange rates in relating the currency of one country to that of another. Until you understand these two concepts, there is no meaning whatsoever in the term dollar shortage. If you are interested in learning more about the basic principles of economics, write the University of Chicago Roundtable Home Study for a leaflet describing the course Economics in the Modern World.
Today's roundtable originated in the Mitchell Tower studios of the University of Chicago. The National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations have cooperated in the presentation of this discussion, which brings the American listener various shades of opinion on important public issues.